Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and we have got four Champions League games to discuss, all of which had some pretty fascinating moments. To break them down, much like Liverpool at present, we've got a bit of a threadbare squad. Ryan is off, Joe is off, that leaves myself, and the stalwart, the ever-present, the man who would never take a mid-season vacation, it's Graham Ruthven. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Taylor. Yeah, Ryan and Joe decided they only want to talk about bad Champions League matches this season, so they bailed out for this one.
And we even tempted Joe with Columbus winning a historic game on the road in Mexico, knocking out Tigres. It was sort of like, Joe, are you sure you don't want to talk about it? He has said he's going to talk about it for Patreon. He's got plenty of going on. Ryan has plenty going on. But Graham, I appreciate that you refuse to take vacations mid-season. You're going to be around for the long haul. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, apart from next week when I'm off for...
What's that now?
2 weeks. I will still be watching the football. I'll just be choosing not to talk about it into a microphone. I couldn't miss this Champions League week, Taylor. This was a Hall of Fame Champions League week. Four games, yeah, at least three goals in each of them. Some of the goals, some of the moments, the way that the matches swung one way and then the other, and every single tie is still on a knife edge, yep, as well. I mean, could you confidently, or anyone confidently, predict the winner of any of them? Like, obviously there are slight favourites in a couple of them, but would you be surprised if any of these ties swung anyway at this point after the first legs?
No, the only one that I would say I felt was done and dusted was Atleti Dortmund for how poor Dortmund looked, or Portman, I guess is the portmanteau we're going to go with from now on, and how strong Atleti looked, and then how much we know that they can kill off ties in that second leg, how good they can be on the defensive side of the ball. But Dortmund getting the one back and maybe getting a little bit of confidence in that game has me thinking even that one is still open. But to your point, Graham, I did not watch the Tuesday games live. I was taking care of two different children, so wasn't really able to pay attention to them. But I did know how many goals were scored in each game, and especially in the Bayern game, the way my friends were texting me, I thought, oh, Bayern won this 4-0. Like, it's going to be a crazy game. There's four goals. They're really opportunistic. They were opportunistic, but 2-2, 3-3 between Man City and Real Madrid was also not one I expected. I'm very happy that we do have lots of goals, lots of stuff to talk about. 18 goals in four matches. Not a bad week, Graham. We've been waiting for the Champions League to really feel like it arrived this season. I'm going to say it probably has at this point.
Yeah, so that 18 goals, I believe, is a record for, and let me get this stat right.
Oh, boy.
The record for a four-game week in the Champions League quarterfinals, there hasn't been as many goals as that ever before in any other Champions League quarterfinals. So that tells you something about how these games went. And yeah, you're right, Taylor. This season's Champions League, I kind of implied it in my opening comments. This season's Champions League has taken a while to get going, but we finally got some proper matches here, and that made me go, ah, yeah, this is why the Champions League is good. This is why this is the pinnacle of this sport. And I think in our Discord, I might have accidentally made an argument for the Super League, where I kind of distilled everything down to good teams playing other good teams makes for better matches. I think that should have been the slogan for the European Super League, and Florentino Perez might have got that one over the line. But nonetheless, putting political issues aside,
yeah, let's do
it
that.
Was good to have these games to watch this week.
Did you have a particular favorite from the four? We're going to start with Real Madrid, Man City, but I'm wondering which one you felt like you enjoyed the most for whatever reason.
I think that was the most enjoyable game. So on Tuesday night, I have my big TV and my smaller TV. Weirdly, the big TV is the second choice because it's like mounted on the wall, so it's not directly in my eye line. The smaller TV is in my eye line. So that's match number one. And so I had Real Madrid, Manchester City as match number one on that TV from the start. And I felt vindicated in my decision because this was an incredible game. The Arsenal-Bayern match was entertaining, and we'll talk about that later, but Real Madrid City was just complete madness. It was a match that sort of defied logic. We got 6 goals from a total expected goals of 1.58 between both teams. City famously play this, you know, intricate possession game. So naturally, all 3 of their goals came from outside the box. that was a bit unexpected, but the way that Real Madrid played and gave Manchester City issues in this game, that was entirely in the script. We've seen this sort of performance from Real Madrid so many times before. There was a bit of variance in that they set up initially, at least, with Bellingham and Vinicius more central and Rodrigo on the left, although Vinicius and Rodrigo rotated a lot and Vinicius was out left and then centrally. But Real Madrid as a team, they are geared towards moving the ball quickly into space and having the runners get in behind. And last season, we saw City go to the Bernabeu and they controlled Real Madrid to death. They stopped them at the source. They were tight in possession and they won that game. I think that second leg was, 4-1 in the second leg in the semi-finals last year against Real Madrid. Not in this match, though. Not at all. In fact, I thought City were really slack by their own high standards in midfield, where they gave up the ball just too many times. Rodri didn't have a great game against Palace at the weekend, and he wasn't terrific here either. And he's come out after this game saying, in no uncertain terms, he needs a rest. He has just played every minute of every game for the last year. And I think you can see that in some of his performances at the moment. Not ideal timing for Manchester City that he needs a rest right in the home stretch of the season and in the Champions League and the Premier League, but nonetheless, that will probably happen at some point. I thought Mateo Kovacic also wasn't very secure in the ball. I can't remember Bernardo Silva, who scores an excellent opener, by the way, from a free kick. But on the ball, I can't remember giving away possession so often in a match. So when you give Real Madrid those chances, they are so quick to get their attackers on their bike. And as we've mentioned a few times in the show this season, City have been vulnerable to fast breaks, especially without Kyle Walker, who is so important to making that high line work. He is out through injury at the moment for Manchester City. He doesn't play this game. So it was a challenging match for Manchester City in a weird way. Despite the fact they had more of the ball, maybe did a little bit more with it, it was a match played on Real Madrid's terms. And at full time, I have to imagine that Manchester City, while it's not a win for them, just coming away from this match, the way that this one unfolded, the circumstances, the way that Real Madrid are, and the fact that they were doing Real Madrid things in this game, Man City are still alive in this tie, certainly still alive. And so I have to imagine there's some relief on their part that that is the case.
I don't disagree, but it is confusing because with City going up the way they did and sort of fighting back the way they did against this Real Madrid team that can be so lethal on the counter, as you expertly outlined, there has to have been a moment where it felt like, okay, we've done it. We've gone away to Madrid. We've gotten the 3-2 win. Now we can come back home and control the game, as you said, kill this tie off, as you said. And then Fede Valverde, who somebody of the two of us drafted, I can't remember which one of us was that valued Fede Valverde, it was me, he scores a ridiculous volley to equalize. Graham, with the mistakes that City were making that allowed Madrid to take the lead and to get some pretty clear opportunities, I suspect the answer to the question I'm about to ask will be a little bit of both. So I'm going to remove that and I'm going to make you choose.
Uh-oh.
Was that City maybe just being tired, not being as sharp as we've come to expect? Or was that Real Madrid doing things that caused problems that made them give up the ball? Because I'm inclined to say it felt more like City being sloppy at times than Real Madrid effectively pressing on a consistent basis.
Well, as Joe has outlined on the show before, Real Madrid are not a particularly good pressing team.
Exactly,
on the odd occasion where they are able to force a turnover high up the pitch, it tends to be like a one or two man press, maybe from Bellingham most notably, did that a couple times in this match with Ortega forced into to long clearances that otherwise I'm sure he would prefer not to have made. But I didn't really see anything from Real Madrid in terms of their setup that was different. I mean, Tchouaméni starts in central defence, picks up a booking within the first few minutes that will rule him out of the return leg, by the way, so that could be a factor for that game. But the way that he played that position, I mean, at times I guess it was a back three in possession, but that's fairly standard for Real Madrid. They play that way even if Tchouaméni isn't in that back line. So no, I didn't really see anything unusual from Real Madrid. It was purely on, if I have to pick one or the other, which apparently I'm being forced to do.
You are.
I'm going to side with Manchester City being sloppy. And look, we've seen it at times. Even in recent games, I mean, that Crystal Palace game that we spoke about on the weekend review, The first Crystal Palace goal that comes in the first few minutes comes from Manchester City conceding possession pretty much under no pressure in the centre circle, and then Mateta smacks it in off the far post. So we have seen this sort of stuff from Manchester City recently. And if they are going to win the Champions League and the Premier League title, those things will need to be tightened up. But there's like 2 months of the season left to play, and I'd imagine that'll happen.
Do we know what the expected return date is for Kyle Walker? It's a hamstring injury, I believe. So the reporting I saw was, I think, mid-April. But I share your concern about him not being there from a City perspective, because the Rodrigo goal feels like Kyle Walker would make up that ground and cause more of a defensive problem, put him under pressure. And I think the whole back line at times looked like maybe they weren't as comfortable without having that defensive cover, that speedy cover in the form of Kyle Walker. Manuel Akanji did what he could, but isn't nearly as fleet of foot. So do we have thoughts on when Kyle Walker returns, or how important that return could be to City getting the result in the second leg?
So my reading, what I've read about Kyle Walker's injury, is that he is touch and go at the moment. Okay. So when I did my tips for this game, there was a chance he might have played in this one. So that kind of suggests that he'll be back pretty soon, hopefully for Manchester City's perspective, for the second leg. He is so important to this Manchester City team. We spoke about there was a listener question we had a few weeks ago about one-trick ponies. Do you remember that one? And I suggested Kyle Walker, and a listener, I think, maybe misinterpreted what I was meaning with Kyle
bad.
Walker.
Kyle Walker is bad.
Yeah. But someone tweeted me. We had a good discussion about it, so that was all fine. But Kyle Walker, his pace is so important to City having that safety net behind their high defensive line. I think he's a top three important player to Manchester City, alongside Rodri and probably Kevin De Bruyne, as the top three most important players to that, to City structure anyway. And you can see when he's not in the team, I mean, there's a great chance for Vinicius Jr. in this game as well when he gets played in behind. I have to imagine that Kyle Walker is jockeying him in that scenario if he's in the pitch in the team. But he's not in the team, and Vinicius Jr. has a clean sight of goal. So he is very important to Manchester City. This was a strange City performance. I've kind of highlighted some of their slackness in midfield. Kevin De Bruyne also on the bench due to illness. Pep Guardiola was really weird in his interview when he was explaining what happened to Kevin De Bruyne. The interviewer, at least on TNT over here in the UK, asked the question, you know, Kevin De Bruyne on the bench doesn't come off the bench. What's the issue with Kevin De Bruyne? Pep Guardiola just looks straight down the camera and goes, vomit. Vomit. Just repeats vomit over and over again. So I think my reading of that is that he was ill.
I think that might be.
Just be normal, Pep, for one day. It's all I ask. But there was also...
Maybe Pep is
game,
one of those guys who like can't handle vomit, and that really was just a very disconcerting moment for him watching Kevin De Bruyne throw up. It was just a PTSD Pep answering vomit.
Or maybe he's so anti-vomit that De Bruyne just like threw up on his mouth a little bit on the team bus, and he's like, you're not in the team.
I regret going down this road. Let's get back on course, Graham. Where were you taking us before I
was taking us
further?
To some of the things that City did well in this game. I think with a bit more penetration, they might have won this comfortably. They were in good areas. It was the execution that let them down. With better execution, they would have created better chances. I don't think this match panned out the way that Pep would have planned it, but City did go punch for punch with Real Madrid at the Bernabeu when Real Madrid were being very Real Madrid-y and lived to tell the tale. So I have to imagine going into that second leg, they see themselves as slight favourites to get through to the semis.
Some unknowable questions for you that I'm now about to ask, and I would love to get your best thoughts on. The first would be the Bernardo Silva opener. For people who did not see, it's a free kick from medium distance, I would say. Andre Lunin, Real Madrid's goalkeeper, clearly expecting that ball to be kind of like a mid-range cross to the far post. He is positioned accordingly for the ball to come in, I think expecting it to go to Erling Haaland. And even as the ball is struck, he sort of cheats to his left, Lunin, expecting the cross. And then I think very quickly realizes, oh no, I have gauged this incorrectly. Tries to get back across, gets a hand to it, but credit to Bernardo Silva for spotting it, for hitting that ball the way he did with the power he did, but also getting that perfect bounce. He hits it in the way that it bounces at the exact right spot to then kick up into the air. Lunin, even though he gets a hand to it, that just like added trajectory, added degree of difficulty, makes it impossible for him to keep out. Into the net, 1-0 to City. And my question for you, Graham, do we think that's a thing that City spotted in watching tape of Lunin, in watching tape of City defend free kicks, that he can be caught out, he can be exploited, he cheats maybe to one side, or do we feel like that's Bernardo Silva in the moment spotting an opportunity and taking it?
I potentially feel like it might be the former, actually. So Andre Lunin is, I wrote a piece for Fought Mob this week about Andre Lunin. Great timing for me to have an article highlighting how good he's been for Real Madrid the week that he has a bit of a clanger in the Champions League for them. But one of the things that Lunin does is he is very commanding at coming for crosses and for set pieces. And we'll talk a little bit later on about a goalkeeper who's not so good at those things. Cough, cough, Gianluigi Donnarumma. But Lunin is very good at that. And that is why he's been such a good deputy for Thibaut Courtois, who's been out for the season injured, all season through injury, is because Courtois does those things as well. So I'd imagine as a defender, having a goalkeeper who plays that position similarly is reassuring if you have your first choice goalkeeper out through injury. And so while it's not something that I have I've seen or identified in some of Lunin's previous matches, it would not surprise me if he does have a tendency to cheat a little bit and anticipate the cross into the middle. Having said that, the execution for Bernardo Silva, as you say, Taylor, with the bounce in front of the goal, it's just incredible. It's just excellent vision for him to recognise that Lunin is so far to the right of the goal. I'd imagine, am I allowed to say a bit of both for this one, or do I have to pick one or the other?
Yeah, you can say a bit of both, that's fine.
Bit of both, but maybe it is City analysing the tape more than Silva in the moment.
I think it is at least something that was spotted or something that was practiced. And I wonder if maybe once there's only one player in the wall, I believe it's Vinicius, there's an idea that, okay, they're setting up to defend across, so now this shot might be on. The main reason why I think it was something that was practiced was because of the celebration. You know that I like to watch celebrations. And when there's a goal scored like this, there can be that moment of like, oh, I can't believe he did it. Like just you can watch the hand gestures. The way that every City player just holds their hands up in the air like, it worked, was a very strong, you guys were hoping this might happen, and it did. So that's a shot from outside the box. As you mentioned, Graham, both of City's other goals coming from outside the box. Phil Foden comes in. I think the very first thing he does is cut inside, shoot, and that one is caught and saved by Lunin. But then he shoots from a very similar position and scores. Gvardiol then scores. My question for you, the unknowable question number two, when, in your mind, is it a tactic to shoot from distance? Because that is something that felt like they were encouraged to do, and I'm wondering if that was Real Madrid have numbers back, Lunin might be shaky, take your shots, just pepper the goal, see what happens. I'm wondering if that's the instruction. I'm wondering if it was just individuals deciding we got to make something happen. When for you does distance shooting that probably has a low XG become a useful tactic?
Well, obviously I'm not in that dressing room, which thankfully I'm
I was expecting
for,
you were, and now I'm frustrated. Go ahead.
I'm grateful I'm not in that Man City dressing room. I've seen enough of Pep Guardiola's weird interviews to know that's not a place that I want to be. So I don't know the answer for certain, but this is a thing that has been more common with Manchester City since they signed Haaland, right? There are games where Erling Haaland, I didn't think Erling Haaland in this game was particularly influential. He had a chance in the first 10 minutes that Lunin saves at the near post. But other than that, doesn't really have much of a sight of goal, didn't really feel like he's getting involved in the build-up play, which is common, of course, for him. But I think in games where that happens, where they're not activating Erling Haaland, there is a recognition of the space that is in front of the defence. And we've seen that before with Manchester City. There's the game where Phil Foden in the Premier League recently cut in off the right side, fired one in the top corner. I remember that being highlighted. I can't remember who it was against, but it was fairly recently this season. That was highlighted as something that City had been building up to in that game. I think with the Foden goal here, it's certainly a factor where you can see in the way that Man City work that opportunity, they are waiting for the clear sight of goal. And of course, the execution from Phil Foden is just ridiculous to find the top corner with that level of power. So you still need like a top quality, elite level player to stick it in the top corner from the edge of the box. But here's the thing, Man City have those players. The Josco Gvardiol one, I cannot believe that one's by design. For one thing, it's Josco Gvardiol, who is not the player that you want to have in that situation. For another thing, his first touch is the thing that leads him into the shot. I can't imagine that when he takes control of that ball, he's thinking, I'm getting this out of my feet and I'm getting a shot on goal. He kind of runs after the first touch and realizes that the best option available to him is to smack it at goal, and it goes in the back of the net. So I don't think that goal was an illustration of any kind of like strategical thinking from Manchester City, but I have to imagine the Phil Foden one was.
For Real Madrid, we haven't talked much about them. I would just say that I think my favorite thing about this team, we've talked about it many times in the past, is just how dynamic that lineup with Vinicius, Rodrigo, and Bellingham can be. And I think, to your earlier point, that this is really poised on a knife edge, maybe City feeling a little more confident, I think it's pretty well balanced, because at any given moment, City could be completely dominant. They could have 85% of possession, controlling the game, getting shots, causing Madrid problems. And at any given moment, if one defender overplays, if one defender gets caught too forward, as happened for the Rodrigo goal, they can punish you. And so I think this game remains fascinating for any number of reasons. I am super excited for the second leg. I remain also sort of mind blown that with all of the goals, what we say, 18 goals in four games, I wonder what the odds were if you bet that there would be 18 goals scored over four matches, but Antoine Griezmann, Vinicius Jr., Erling Haaland, Kylian Mbappe, and Robert Lewandowski would combine for zero, whereas your goal scorers are like Gvardiol, Trossard, Christensen. Everybody saw that coming, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That did cross my mind, actually, in particular with Bellingham, Haaland, and Mbappe, who at the moment I think most people would say are probably the three best players in the world. I'm not saying they had bad games, but you wouldn't say that they made a big impact on these games this weekend. It just shows the quality that these teams have, that even when those players aren't at their best, they still have others who can step up and produce those incredible moments. The thing about Real Madrid, when you're talking about your admiration, your love of Real Madrid, Taylor, and the way that they play, one of the things that kind of dawned on me watching...
My appreciation. I can't say I love Real Madrid, but I can say
I'll say I love Real Madrid. Okay. The way that they are my favorite team to watch in world football right now, because they kind of just defy logic. Like, everything you think is true is not true with Real Madrid, and I just love that. But the watching this game...
Got it, cool.
Exactly, yeah. The thing about them is they have such incredible individuals who are so good at driving at opponents. And I'll explain why I find that so incredible. The number of times that City had a numerical advantage against Vinicius or Rodrigo or Fede Valverde, it would be a 3-on-1 or something. And this is what I mean when I say Real Madrid defy logic. Nine times out of 10 in that situation, you think, oh, the defensive team has got this sorted. They've got this sorted. They're going to win the ball. It's not going to amount to anything. Real Madrid are still able to create something in those moments. The players that they have are not just geared to play the way that they play. They are the best players in the world at playing the way that they play. And it just makes it so difficult to play against them. Like, everything that we know about the modern game is about systems and combinations and how this player combines with this sort of player. Real Madrid take that out of the equation. A lot of the times it's just, my player is better than your player. And I kind of love that. I kind of love that.
I kind of love it too. I'm kind of loving that we get a return leg of this one. I cannot wait. But I can't wait for the next game we're going to talk about, because we're going to take a break. And then we'll come back to talk about Arsenal and Bayern's 2-2 draw. Back soon.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs, who would like to remind you, when you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. You don't want to end up with Ryan, Graham, and Joe. Just kidding. Just kidding. Very much just kidding. Because I was very fortunate to have the three of them all join the show. And I had existing relationships with all three of them that allowed me to know that they could handle the amount of work that would be required, that they could be diligent in their tasks and be very effective on mic. And all three of them are. But again, that's because you have the existing relationship. If you don't feel like you have that with potential hires, then LinkedIn is going to make it very, very easy, and they're going to make it feel like you're connected to that person. They have a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire, because it gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. But when you are setting the requirements and making it very specific as to what you're looking for, you can very quickly narrow it down to find the right candidate for that position. Hiring is easy when you have that many candidates. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. And LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and you can too. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Thank you very much to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's episode. Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. Graham Ruffin, let's go to Arsenal's 2-2 draw with Bayern. I want to start with Bayern for a moment, because this result sort of feels like a good representation of their season, in that early on, they go 1-0 down. It feels like Arsenal are completely dominant, are completely overloading one side, Bayern's left side, Arsenal's right. Martin Odegaard is spraying passes and lifting balls in behind. And I thought for a moment this could go 2 or 3-0. I thought maybe Bayern Munich picking up a yellow card early, that could be a problem for them. And then they score a goal. And then Harry Kane gets a penalty. And it finishes in a draw. And it's not a bad result by any stretch of the imagination for Bayern. In some ways, it's a good result. But it still has those moments of like, oh, wow, they look completely not at the races. Yeah. Alphonso Davies looks poor. What is up with this team? And then they still find a way to get a draw.
Yeah, halfway through this game, there was a realization, I think, on everyone at the Emirates as well. By the way, no away fans at this game, which was a weird thing. Bayern Munich have a sanction against them, so it was an 100% Arsenal crowd. And I think it dawned on everyone at the same time, oh no, it's Bayern Munich. Like, they came into this game thinking, it's fine, it's the second team in the Bundesliga that might even finish third. They've not been very good, they're sacked their manager. Oh wait, no, we've made a horrible mistake, this is still Bayern Munich. Obviously, in the end, Arsenal get the equalising goal, they're still very much in this tie. But watching Bayern produce a largely competent performance, it wasn't a 90-minute performance by any stretch. There were moments and periods in this game where it was the Bayern Munich from this season. But watching them produce, as I say, a largely competent performance, I sort of wondered if this was actually a good matchup for them. And this was something that maybe I'd underestimated going into this game. So in the Bundesliga, they are the team who have to control the game and play through. And then on the other side of the ball, they get caught high up, like we saw against Heidenheim at the weekend. But here, they could sit a little bit deeper. Goretzka and Laimer can shuffle from side to side. I don't think there's a huge amount of creativity between those two players, although Goretzka is the one who sets up Gnabry for the equaliser. But in this game, that's not much of an issue. In the Bundesliga, that is more of an issue when they're having to play through, is not having a great deal of creativity between those two. Musiala and Kane, the way that they were setting up with Bayern in the 4-4-2, and they were the two at the head of the formation, Musiala and Kane can prevent Arsenal playing through the middle. Arsenal can have more of the ball, but there's still space for Sané, Musiala and Kane to run into, as they were often being left forward. It allowed Bayern to play more to their strengths and mask some of their weaknesses. And I think I've maybe underestimated how, against stronger caliber teams like Arsenal, that might actually favour them over what we've seen in the Bundesliga this season.
But was there any sort of example to you where Bayern were able to use expansive and rapid counter-attacking football to get goals? What are you talking about, Graham? I can't possibly imagine. That first goal was a thing of wonder. The ball from Sané into, is it Goretzka who then plays it to Gnabry for the goal? The ball from Sané, if you pause when he hits it, is so impressive in that you look at it and think, like, who is he playing this to? Like, that's an underhit pass to Gnabry. I don't know how that's... Oh, he played into perfect space for Goretzka to take in stride through two Arsenal defenders who are taken out by the pass but had better position. It is such a good reminder of how good Bayern Munich can be in those types of moments and how special Leroy Sané can be with that vision, yeah. But then also the dribbling ability to draw the penalty, which Saliba had the audacity to complain about. It's like, dude, you just completely took a dude out and didn't get near the ball. What are you complaining about? But credit to Leroy Sané for everything he did for the first goal and for the second.
Yeah, Sané was excellent. He gave Kvyat a really difficult first half, to the extent that he was hooked at halftime for Zinchenko. And that meant, I think what that meant was, because Zinchenko can be vulnerable against attacking runners as well. But I think that what that meant was Gabriel was in the back three and kind of shuffling over. So it was more of a Gabriel versus Sané battle in the second half. So maybe didn't have the same joy after that. But yeah, the run from Sané for the Kane penalty was outrageous. I don't know if you caught the very start of this move, but Manuel Neuer juggles the ball from the back to kick it over an Arsenal player to the fullback position.
Yeah, as if to say, don't worry everybody, I'm still Manuel Neuer and I will still do crazy things that could be calamitous but somehow never are.
I mean, it's absolutely nuts. I've waited my whole life for one of those Manuel Neuer moments to backfire, and they never okay. seem to, or not very often anyway.
I had the same point that there, with how many times he has tried weird audacious stuff, how many times he's come out for 40-yard headers or for 50-yard tackles, I really cannot remember obvious moments of Neuer getting caught the way we do with, like, Jens Lehmann, where he has ridiculous moments coming off his line. It is a reminder that Manuel Neuer was the best goalkeeper in the world and might not still be anymore, but still has those moments. And I love it in juxtaposition to David Raya for that first goal, coming 40 yards out and then being like, whoops, nope, never mind, let me sprint back to my... And I feel like Neuer was like, oh, you want to get headlines for being weird? Buckle up, buddy.
Nobody will ever beat Manuel Neuer for weirdness. So yeah, that was a weird way for that move to start. But the run from Sané is incredible. He picks the ball up in his own half, I think about 10 yards into his own half. He does like a kind of spin around an Arsenal player at some point, just keeps running and running and running. The defending from Arsenal isn't great. There's a weird sort of half tackle from Gabriel where he kind of goes in and then pulls back out again. And I think what that does is it puts White off. It creates that moment of hesitation from Ben White, whereas if there's not that tackle, there's not that distraction, maybe he's the one to make the engagement to win the duel. But Sané just kind of slinks through, and it was so direct, and it was the sort of thing that we were seeing from Sané regularly earlier in the season. I think people have forgotten that. The first 2-3 months of the season, everyone was saying, there's the Leroy Sané that Man City thought he was going to be, that Bayern Munich thought he was going to be when they signed him from Manchester City initially. I thought Musiala as well was fairly impressive, although most of his importance was, as I kind of referenced earlier on, off the ball. It was him and Kane at the top of the 4-4-2, and that was stopping Arsenal from playing through the middle. I don't think Kane had a huge influence in open play anyway. Obviously, there is the penalty, which is just so coolly taken. That little delay is like a skill you unlock once you score 300 goals or something, just to have that confidence. So it's a very, very nice penalty. But there were still a few moments from him where he would drop deep and then Sané and Musiala would spin in behind. And again, that took me back to the start of the season where we were talking about how Kane would work in this Bayern Munich team. And that was one of the things that we highlighted, was his ability to spin in behind and how Bayern Munich have players who are perfect to then burst into the space that he creates. So we saw some of that in this game. Kane, incidentally, has now scored more goals at the Emirates than any opposition player. He's now overtaken Jamie Vardy and Diogo Jota. So I bet Arsenal were delighted to see not just him back. Let's not forget Eric Dier making his return to North London as well. We can never forget about Eric Dier.
We did have some weird like past relationships coming back in a few of these different games. Dier and Kane, very notably among those. Flipping it around for a moment, I wanted to give a little bit of praise slash credit to Ben White, who I thought was once again very good in the attacking side of things. Picks out Saka, I think, early on for a really good shooting opportunity. I thought got most of his passes right and is consistently so important to getting Saka into 1v1 situations because he is so far forward, Ben White, that he draws out a defender and that opens up space. But I also mostly spotlight him because for that goal for the Gnabry opener or equalizer, Ben White gets a little bit posterized. And I think I saw one commentator or heard one commentator, one of the analysts talking about like how he's got to do better there. He's got to anticipate. He's got to be able to make a play to shut that down. And when Arsenal turn the ball over that, and it leads to that goal, when Sané has that turn and nobody sees it coming, Ben White is a good 20 to 25 yards behind Gnabry and closes that gap so effectively, so quickly. And then it really is just thinking like, oh, okay, this play is done, and then it's not done. But I think he does really well to be alert to the threat to get back into the position as best he can. Obviously can't make a play, but I still thought Ben White overall had a solid game. And I thought Mikel Arteta had a pretty solid managerial game, Graham. I thought some of the changes he made, including that halftime adjustment, paying dividends down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. The changes that Arteta made off the bench in the second half had a real impact. Gabriel Jesus is just so good at creating chances in tight spaces like he did for the Trossard equaliser. Of course, Trossard being the other sub who made an impression. I'm kind of conflicted on this Arsenal performance, which is a common theme for a lot of teams in this week's Champions League ties. One of the big takeaways I had from this game, and this is sort of like an intangible vibesy thing, but there were periods in this game, especially in the first half, where it really came across that Arsenal were a team that haven't been in this sort of situation in the Champions League before, which is, of course, what they are. They are still a young team. They are learning on the job. I thought there was some franticness to some of their play. And I noticed James Bench, who I think he's writing for CBS these days, but he's an Arsenal writer, an Arsenal fan. He noted the same thing in the first half. He tweeted something to the effect of, it's almost like at points in these matches, Arsenal forget how much time they have in the game. Even when they're 1-0 ahead, it's like, we need the second goal, we need the third goal immediately. And obviously it'd be great if they could get the second or third goal, but just a little bit more awareness of the situation and game management, and especially after Gnabry equalised, a more experienced team probably would have just taken the sting out of the match at that point. But for Arsenal, it was like, they're committing players forward, we need to get back ahead, and that suited Bayern, who were leaving Kane, Musiala and Sané forward to play in the counter, and then they get the second goal. So that's a kind of vibesy thing, but there were still a lot of good things in the Arsenal performance. I thought Saka was a consistent threat on the right side. His first goal finish is just lovely. As you've highlighted, Taylor, the little pass inside from Ben White is so well weighted, and the relationship between those two is really good. There was spacing behind Alphonso Davies, who will, by the way, missed the second leg through suspension, so that'll be a factor.
He didn't look great in this one, in my opinion. No, that's not just my Jedi Robinson propaganda.
Yeah, I was going to say, this helps your pro-Jedi Robinson agenda. No, but he was up against Bukayo Saka and Ben White, who I think are one of the best right sides in European football at this point. For a lot of the match, and this is where there's a lot of conflicting thoughts in my mind, because I've highlighted how effective Bayern were on the counter, but for a lot of this game, I thought Arsenal also did a good job of restricting Bayern to basically Eric Dier long balls into Kane, and then an Arsenal player would sweep up. The problem was that when Bayern were able to play out, they were able to get up the pitch dangerously. So, a really entertaining game. I'm struggling to give you like a one-line summary of how this match panned out, because it swung back and forth and teams did good things and bad things, but certainly very entertaining and on a knife edge for the second leg.
I think that's, there you go. That's it. That's the line. Entertaining, on a knife's edge for the second leg. Graham, two quick other little things to discuss from this game. The first, the Saka penalty shout at the end. I'm inclined to say that was correctly not given. How say you?
Yeah, I agree. Saka was absolutely furious at full-time. He thought he should have been awarded it. Right at the end, it's like the very last action of the game. The referee blows the full-time whistle after it. To me, so in real time watching it, I'm thinking penalty. Initially, that's a clear penalty. Manuel Neuer has clearly made contact with Bukayo Saka, but then the replays show that To me, it looks like Saka kind of kicks out at Neuer. Like, he initiates the contact.
There's that one angle that it looks really damning.
Yeah. He kind of kicks out. And to such an extent that I kind of think he was already past Neuer. Yeah. Like, he kind of hangs the leg in to the point where I think you were around him. Like, if you just continued running, you would have had an open goal to finish into the back of. So, that not a penalty for me. The more interesting one, though, I don't know if you've caught this, Taylor. It sounds like you have.
Uh-huh.
Tuchel highlighted after the match this incident that I don't think anyone caught in real time. So, it was around the 66th minute, and the referee blows, and David Raya takes the goal kick to Gabriel, who is clearly not paying attention or something, and picks it up with his hands. That's more interesting because by the letter of the law, that is a penalty, and it wasn't caught by anybody besides Thomas Tuchel.
Harry Kane. Harry Kane turns around and runs to the ref with his arms out and says, like, handball, handball. And I think maybe Leroy Sané as well is alive to that moment. Gabriel, like really doesn't help the situation by very slowly putting the ball down. Like, if I'm, it's T-Rex style. If I move slowly, maybe they won't notice. And then he passes it back to David Raya as if to say, like, I'm taking the goal kick now. David Raya then, I think, gets play back underway, and we all just move swiftly along. I think the ref afterward explained his decision making. Go ahead, Graham.
I think this is David Raya's fault, and I'll explain why. So until last night, I thought, Gabriel, what are you doing? Don't pick the ball up with your hands inside the box. And I still think that to a certain extent. But someone put a compilation together of all the times that Arsenal have done something similar to this. I don't know. You know how Joe highlighted the Brighton thing where they put the foot on top of the ball and it's like bait to get the press out to them? I don't know if this is what Arsenal are trying to do with that, but time and time again this season, Raya rolls the ball to Gabriel and he puts the ball down and takes the goal kick. But the difference is Raya does it with his hands every other time. So the play's not live. This time, David Raya does it with his foot, as in taking the goal kick. So Gabriel, just in with muscle memory, does what he normally does, puts his hands on the ball, but then kind of realizes that it's been kicked to him, which is where you get the moment of, did anyone see that from Gabriel? It seems like nobody did see it. Or Kane and Sané did, but the referee didn't. By the letter of the law, that's a penalty, right? Yep. But am I the only one who feels it would have been a bit jobs-worthy of the referee to give that as a penalty? Because it's just such a weird moment. It's not like Arsenal have, like, gained an advantage by doing it. I mean, it would not have surprised me, and I could see the reasoning if the referee had given a penalty. But I'm kind of okay with it not being a penalty. I think it kind of warps the game a little bit if you give the penalty in that moment.
The referee supposedly said to Harry Kane, it's a kid's mistake, and that he wasn't giving a penalty in a quarterfinal for a moment like that. Which I think speaks to your point of it's not really a competitive advantage. They're not trying to game the system. I think Raya is absolutely putting that ball into play because he waits for the whistle before he kicks it.
Yeah.
But I still think it would have been a slightly silly, albeit defensible, decision to give that penalty, but I think the same goes for not giving it. There are shades there of what I want to say was, like, not that long ago, but I'm now realizing has to have been well over a decade ago, probably 12 to 13 years ago. There's the moment when I believe it's Robin Van Persie, then playing for Arsenal, doesn't hear the whistle go because the crowd is so loud. It's in a Champions League, maybe semifinal, quarterfinal, and has a shot thinking play is still live, but it's not. The whistle's been blown. RVP's on a yellow. Or no, it was... Yeah, it's Robin Van Persie. He's on a yellow, kicks it, and then the ref gives him a second yellow for time-wasting, basically. He's sent off, and it changes the tie completely. That was what I thought of. Like, I don't think he meant to do that. I don't think he was time-wasting. I don't think he heard the whistle, and it completely changes the game. I think this would have been something similar, where it kind of completely changes the outcome, or potentially does. So, in the end, I am okay with that penalty not being given, though I have no vested interest one way or the other, and I'm guessing Arsenal fans might, or Bayern fans, excuse me, might disagree with that one. But Graham, let's move swiftly on from controversial refereeing decisions to a game which, checking again, I don't believe had any. We're going to come to PSG Barcelona later. Let's get to Atleti 2, Dortmund 1 first. This was a definitive Dortmund performance right up until they got one goal, and then I'm still kind of confused by it. We talked about this in the introduction, but it was Dortmund just looking really bad. It's Mats Hummels making a couple different mistakes. It's the goalkeeper making a mistake. Kobel passing maybe when he shouldn't have. It's just a lot of individual errors that come back and lead to Atleti going 2-0 up. I guess credit to Dortmund that they pull one back to make this one still competitive. But it was a very Dortmund performance, which is maybe a lazy way to describe it, but in my mind, accurate for the way things played out.
No, I think that's fair. Very Dortmund of Dortmund. And for the first kind of, certainly the first half, it looked like Atleti were not very Atletico Madrid until, oh wait, no, they're still Atletico Madrid in the yep. second half. This was probably the least engrossing of the four quarterfinals, but that honestly says more about the quality of the other games.
Yeah.
Because this was still a good game. I wasn't convinced it was going to be a good game or a competitive game, at least when Atletico Madrid looked to be running away with it in the first half. It was an intense start by Atleti, and they were sharp with a lot of their decision making in the final third, as we saw for their two goals. But the real reason that Atleti ended up 2-0 up within the first 30 minutes was that Dortmund were just so slack. The first goal is a complete calamity from Dortmund playing out from the back. I think Kobel's at fault. I can't remember who takes the pass. Matson. Mm-hmm. I think he's at fault. And then there's a third Dortmund player who is also at fault in that moment. So just a collective disaster for Dortmund in that moment. The defending from Mats Hummels for the second Atleti goal is also bizarre. I've watched this a few times and I'm not a defender. I'm barely a soccer player at this point, but I've never been a defender, even when I used to play. I can't work out why he calls off Schlotterbeck in that moment, who wasn't under a lot of pressure. Now, Hummels' body shape is maybe a little bit better to receive the ball. I think it's like an Atleti throw-in, or certainly a clipped ball forward. But he comes so far over that when he then makes the mistake, he tries to take it down on his chest, and it goes a little bit further out from his chest than he anticipates, and Atleti pick it up. There's a giant hole in the Dortmund defence, which Atleti swiftly exploited through, I think, Antoine Griezmann is the one who picks it up. In general, I thought Dortmund's defensive structure in the first half was terrible. They just couldn't get into a rest defence. It was so fragmented. Nobody seemed to know the roles within that team. Had Samuel Leno put in that chance at the back post to make it 3-0, I think after like 70 minutes or whatever that was, it's probably tie over. And I think that will be the regret for Atleti, that they didn't put this one away when they had the opportunity, and this tie is very much still alive.
Two things there. I will praise Leno. I will say that is a very good save by Kobel to get across to make that save to keep it at 2-0 instead of 3-0 at that point. But also, Leno, for the second goal, his first or his only, it's Morata, I think, picks up the loose ball. He plays a first-time ball to Griezmann, who is just so smart in those moments that I think a lesser player drives it goal and feels like, oh, it's an opportunity, and takes a touch and tries to get a shot, but does have defenders around him. It's not a clear-cut opportunity, but instead lets the ball roll across him, lets the defenders sort of come in and collapse on him, and then with his first touch just has a deft little lift up
so
in the
good.
Air.
It's so good.
Yeah, to Samuel Leno, who I believe controls with his right and then shoots with his right. It's a really delicate and difficult finish, but he does it really well. It's a moment that is sort of smash and grab, but also really technically precise at the same time. So I love that goal from Atleti. I share your confusion around what Dortmund were doing. My assumption is that they were roughly trying to mirror the shape of Atleti, who were at times basically in a 3-5-2. The shape was a bit more fluid, and then in the second half, they're very much defending in a 4-4-2, two banks of four sort of thing. But Dortmund, meanwhile, come out like theoretically in a 4-2-3-1, at times it looks like that, but then you get Emre Can dropping between Schlotterbeck and Hummels, you get Matson moving into the middle, you get Ryerson pushing very far forward on the right wing, Sancho moving inside, Adeyemi staying wide, but then Nmecha like moving into the half space. So regularly it's like a 3-2-5, but almost at times like a 3-2-0-5 in the first half. And I think that goes a long way towards explaining why Dortmund weren't able to look comfortable defensively, because when they would win it back, there's not many passing options. You kind of have to go long if you want to find anybody. And while you're waiting for something to develop, you're getting pressed by Atleti, who are obviously a very good team, who are well-drilled and know how they want to play. So I think through that lens, I'm less surprised by the way things played out in the first half, and maybe a little more surprised that Dortmund are able to get back into it.
Yeah.
A lot of that has to do with, I think, some of the changes made by Edin Terzic. Chief among them would be bringing on Sebastian Haller, who is such a difference maker for this Dortmund team.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Brandt as well coming on for Mecha probably helped, with Brandt being more of a technician. He has a header. Not a chance you would expect a technician to have. I can't imagine Julian Brandt has had many headed chances, but right at the end, he has a header off the woodwork, which obviously might have made this 2-2, and that maybe swings the tie in Dortmund's favour ahead of the second leg. But yeah, you're right, Taylor. The other influential change for Dortmund was Haller coming on for Füllkrug. I think Haller is still building up his fitness. Obviously, that was a problem for him at AFCON, where he still manages to score the winner in the final. But he's just a much more rounded and effective frontman than Füllkrug, who I kind of think of maybe unfairly as like a big battering ram, and he has his uses, but Haller gets you up the pitch. He brings others into the game. If you look at his movement for the goal, he just keeps a bit of separation from the ball and then times his run as the Atleti defence gets broken up and gets pulled towards the ball. And I just don't think you see that sort of thing from Füllkrug. So if he is fit enough, Haller should absolutely be starting the second leg. He's the kind of difference maker that could put Dortmund into the semi-finals. Just to flip it slightly towards Atleti and theirs.
About Haller?
Yeah, on you go.
I love me some Dimitar Berbatov. There are shades of Dimitar Berbatov to what Haller does. Like, that goal is a prime, like, there's a deflection in there, but somehow it spills to him and he's able to swivel really well, know exactly where he is and finish well. He has those moments of sort of silky control that you don't expect, while also being physically solid without like actually like battling the way you might see Füllkrug do. He has a like strength that maybe you don't expect to be there, Haller, until he just holds somebody off seemingly effortlessly and then plays a perfect like through ball at the same time. He's a very special player.
Yeah.
It's really nice to see him on the pitch.
I also think in his movement, I'm not saying this is a perfect analogy because he maybe doesn't have the kind of acrobatic nature of the player I'm about to compare him to, but like Zlatan movement is also there's Zlatan movement to the way that he that thing I just mentioned there with the Dortmund goal, where he just keeps that separation and times the run as Atleti fragment. That's something that Zlatan used to do a lot. So yeah, he's a quality player. He has to start if he's fit enough. With Atleti in the second half, the thing I found confusing about the way this match changed was Atletico Madrid's apparent decision to abandon their high press that worked so well in the first half. Now, I don't know if that's a fitness thing. I don't know if that is, I think this is more likely, Diego Simeone just like reverting back to his default and kind of waking up and realizing where he is and thinking, we're in a Champions League knockout game, we have to revert back to default, and this is the way that Atletico Madrid play. But in the first half, Atleti were putting Dortmund under pressure with the two strikers and the eights pushing high, and that seemed to stop in the second half, and it allowed Dortmund to get a foothold in the game. They had much more control in that match. I think part of that is due to Brandt and Haller coming off the bench. But nonetheless, I can't really fully understand why. If Atleti score a third goal in this game, this tie's dead.
Yep.
And this is maybe the risk-reward balance that Simeone has at times struggled to get right over the course of his career. But I was kind of disappointed from their perspective that they weren't able to push for that third goal, which is the difference with Atleti from them being like a tier two team and a tier one team. It's one of the reasons that I can't quite push them up into the favourites bracket.
We shall see how it all plays out. We're going to take a quick break. We've got one more game to discuss, and it was a doozy. Back soon. Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode. Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. Graham Ruthven, one game still to be discussed. Barcelona getting the 3-2 win on the road at PSG. I asked you in the beginning, what was your favorite game? I think this was my favorite game of the round because it was just so ridiculously wide open. Both teams at times seemingly just going with a, like, who needs defense? It's the New York Knicks under Mike D'Antoni. We're going to win every game 145 to 140. This game had attacks at both ends consistently, pretty constantly almost. You had star players doing star things. Even if Mbappe isn't scoring, he looked like a threat that had Barcelona pretty nervous pretty regularly. You get the Dembele revenge goal. You get Barcelona via Andreas Christensen getting the winner. Lots of twists and turns along the way, and a lot of them having to do with Gigi Donnarumma maybe not being the best goalkeeper.
He's certainly not a Luis Enrique goalkeeper with some of his distribution.
Yeah.
Even from set pieces, he has this incredible knack, Donnarumma. I think he's like 6'7" tall. He has this knack to make himself smaller at set pieces. The winner from Andreas Christensen, he just doesn't come off his line, and that is a cross right into the six-yard box. And look, maybe I'm being old-fashioned here, maybe I'm being a proper football man, but a cross into the six-yard box when you've got a 6'7" goalkeeper, I'm wanting my goalkeeper to come and claim that. And some of his distribution was just as disastrous. I think it's the second Barcelona goal that leads to his distribution error, kind of leads to the second Barcelona goal.
So.
But yeah, he... I can see the transition that's happening at PSG under Lucho. I listened to another podcast and their narrative was very much like same old PSG. And I can understand why people would think that. But I actually think that's a little bit lazy with this PSG team. You can see with Lucho, he is making changes. They are playing a different way. Even in this game, there are periods of control. The way that he changes for the start of the second half with Ousmane Dembele being moved into central position. I just don't think we saw that level of intelligence in the last few years from PSG. So there are things that are changing at PSG, but you look at Donnarumma, some other players here seem like an awkward fit. So this might have to be written off as a transitional season for PSG, but they honestly, if they end up going out of this tie, they really should not throw the baby out with the bathwater because they are onto something at least better under Luis Enrique. And I know Mbappe's likely going to be leaving at the end of the season, but I do see a team that's on an upward trajectory, even though this result ultimately ends up going against them.
100% agree. In the way that I said, like, the Dortmund game felt like a definitive Dortmund performance, this did not feel that way for PSG, or maybe more accurately, felt like a definitive PSG performance under Luis Enrique, because I think Luis Enrique has got them playing better football. Last season and in seasons past, if they come out in a 4-3-3, it is a very clear 4-3-3 with the three players that were like this three marquee players playing in the roles you expect them to play, and they are going to do the attacking thing and then not do the defensive thing. Goals can happen in big swings because you don't have a lot of the defensive presence, and sometimes the tactics do feel like they are get the ball to one of our three stars and let's see what happens. In this game, I found PSG fascinating and confusing in equal measure because they were so fluid in their approach and shape that they had players kind of popping up all over the place. So if you see it listed on like FotMob, for example, it's listed as a 4-3-3. I don't think that's accurate. It felt more like a 4-2-2-2, where the midfield two were in a box and then the wide two of Mbappe and Dembele stayed very wide, stayed very forward. That does get adjusted, as you said, in the second half when there is that change. I think it's Asensio comes out, and I felt like he was the player who wasn't having the impact and seemed to be getting visibly frustrated in a way that a player who maybe isn't on the same page as his teammates starts to look. In comes Bradley Barcola, who I thought was excellent when he comes on. And so now you've got Mbappe playing more central. You've got Dembele on the left. You've got Barcola on the right. And they looked lethal at times in that second half. They get the goal. They get two goals, in the second half. And then Barcelona able to come back and fight to get the win. But for me, this was a really impressive performance from PSG and a reminder that Luis Enrique is a very good manager, even if they didn't get the win.
Yeah, they were struggling a bit in the first half, PSG, due to the things you highlight there, Taylor, particularly with Asensio. So just felt like they lacked a focal point in attack. Mm-hmm. Asensio was picked to play through the middle. But the way Asensio plays, and I'm a massive fan of Marco Asensio and watched him a huge amount over the course of his career. I was at a Clásico when he scored an incredible goal, one of the best goals of his career. So I've always been a bit of a fan of his. But the way that he plays, he needs angles. He needs to be able to come inside to get onto his left foot. And he, in that position, he's just not able to do that. So Lucho has been very imaginative with using Usman Dembele in a central position this season. I remember we highlighted it after the Real Sociedad round of 16 game, and it worked so effectively. I'm not entirely sure what leads him to think that Asensio can play in that central position. It didn't work. Barca were quite happy to give PSG the ball because of the way that it allowed them to close up the space between the lines and in behind. So Mbappe in that first half didn't feel like he was much of a factor. And then Barcelona had space to break out, to get out, to be more direct, which is something we saw from them in this game. So at that point, it was a bit of a struggle for PSG. But as you say, Taylor, they make the changes. Lucho makes the, I think it's just one change actually at halftime. Mm-hmm. Asensio who comes off, it's Bradley Barcola who comes on. And Dembele as the central figure, just it works perfectly. Mm-hmm. I thought it changed the match. PSG looked much more incisive. They were quicker. They were passing longer distances as well, which I know is not something that I would necessarily associate with a Lucho team. He's largely about short passes, but this is where he has kind of merged his Spain philosophy with the players that he's got at PSG and getting those players on their bite, like Mbappe, like Barcola, who's been excellent since the turn of the year. Was key to PSG kind of turning around this match in the second half. But then, of course, they didn't turn around this match by full time because it swings back towards Barcelona. Xavi makes some changes of his own.
Yes, he does.
And two of them in particular helped turn it back towards Barcelona. First of all, Pedri comes on. What an incredible pass for the equaliser. It is. The finish from Rafinha on the volley with outside of his boot is incredible as well. But the pass from Pedri, it's just so nonchalant, so perfect, into Rafinha's stride. He's got about 2 yards, maybe even less than 2 yards, like a yard to hit with that pass, with the run that Rafinha's making, mm-hmm. with the defensive high line, with the goalkeeper being there. By the way, that is the goal that comes from Donnarumma kicking it out pretty aimlessly. And that I can't mm-hmm. imagine that he thought that Pedri was going to pull off that pass and Rafinha that finish. But nonetheless, it comes from that. So Pedri was incredible in that moment. The other impactful change was Christensen, who scored with his first touch off the bench from a corner kick. Again, I don't think Donnarumma's contribution helps PSG in that moment, but Xavi put on Christensen to provide a bit more height, and it worked. And the way that Barcelona were set up at the end as well, I thought was quite clever. They had Ferran Torres and João Félix to be a bit more narrow, to pinch PSG when they had the ball late on. So even in that change, I thought it was good game management by Xavi. And their first half performance as well, I thought was pretty mature, mm. which was quite something given the youthful age of that team. You had two 17-year-olds in the lineup, Lamine Yamal and Kubasi, who I thought was excellent in this game. The Catalan press are kind of comparing him to Ronald Koeman in the way that he's playing, the way that he just has like a composure about him, the way that he can play out from the back. And I thought against Mbappe, he didn't really put a foot wrong as far as you can against a player like Kylian Mbappe. I just thought he was very impressive as well.
It's crazy how good he looked for being a teenager. Lamine Yamal, the same. I think it's a credit to Xavi, and I wonder, like, maybe it's injury forcing his hand. I do wonder if him announcing he's leaving, we'll see what happens there, like, gives him some of that flexibility to be like, you know what, I'm starting a teenager here, I'm starting a teenager there, we'll see what happens. I'm going to start Sergio Roberto as a holding midfielder, and then I'm going to continue to use Ilkay Gundogan in a more advanced position, because Ilkay Gundogan, quietly one of the most underrated players in Europe. I feel like he is so exceptionally good. I was kicking myself to go back to the draft for not drafting him, because he is so good, especially as an attacking force. Doing a lot of like Luka Modric things, the way that he would do when Benzema was the striker for Real Madrid. It feels like Lewandowski was doing a good Benzema impression, Gundogan was doing a good Modric impression, and a lot of that leads to some of the goals for Barcelona, the way they're able to kind of combine and transition, the way Lewandowski can drop in, link up play, but then still be involved in the attack. I think it's a really good performance from Barcelona. It's not one I thought I saw coming. I thought this might be like a 3-1 for PSG, so credit to Barca for getting the result in the end.
Taylor, did you catch some of the pre-match stuff between Lucho and Xavi, which was
no?
Was
I've seen headlines and like clip links that I have not selected. What went on?
So basically, you know how before a Champions League game they give a press, managers give a press conference the day before a game when they train at the stadium, and Lucho was in a prickly mood before the game. In particular, when he's asked questions about Xavi, Xavi of course was his captain at Barcelona, so most people would assume there's a relationship there. And basically hit back quite emphatically, saying that his style is closer to the traditional identity of Barcelona than Xavi's, that his is a better fit for Barcelona. I'd kind of broadly agree with him on that. But I did wonder if there'd be some animosity between them during the match, but then I saw, before they're going out in the tunnel before the game, Lucho, like, run over to Xavi and give him a big bear hug and, like, lift him off the ground like a small child. You know when you give a hug to a child and you kind of lift them up in the moment at the same time? So, yeah, not much animosity there. Lucho is a bit of a weird dude. All the top managers seem to be weird dudes, and he is one of them.
All the top managers seem to be weird dudes. Graham, how do you see this shaping up in the return fixture? Donnarumma will, I'm going to assume, not develop advanced foot skills by the time we get the second leg, so that could still be a problem. I'm guessing Kylian Mbappe will be even more hungry to get a goal in that second leg. How do you see things playing out?
I kind of envisage more of the same in this game. I think maybe that's the lazy answer, but I was thinking about this with the Man City-Real Madrid game as well. I think there's a chance in that tie that Manchester City kind of put the foot in the ball a little bit more and do that thing that I talked about they did last season where they kind of control Real Madrid to death. But I also think it's a big possibility that we just get another game like we got this week. And I think the same with Barcelona. Their record at Montjuic, which is where they're playing their home games this season, is not particularly good. Their away record is actually better this season. So that will give PSG some hope that they can turn it around. And traditionally, similar to what I've just said about Manchester City, traditionally with a second leg at Barcelona, you'd think, well, they're going to have 75% of the ball and they're just going to control this game and create opportunities, play through a low defensive block. That's not really how Barcelona are playing at the moment. Even in this game, we've highlighted a lot of the good stuff that they did. They're playing very direct. They're playing long passes into Rafinha from the back and into space. So I kind of anticipate they'll try to do the same again. And if there's one team that is likely or more likely to control the game and kind of gain a foothold and put the foot on the throat of the other team, I kind of think it's PSG, which would be quite a sight to have a Lucho team going to Barcelona and playing that way. I kind of wonder how the Barcelona fans would handle that. I can't imagine they'd handle it very well. So I'm very intrigued as to how this second leg is going to pan out. And with the Man City Real Madrid game, which is the other match, I think that game was the most engrossing. Taylor, you think this one is the most engrossing? I think we can agree that as a pair, these were the best two matches from the round. I have a more difficult time calling how this one is going to pan out in the second leg than the Man City Real Madrid one. Anything could happen. Nothing would surprise me.
I think if they keep finding Rafinha in good shooting positions, that will certainly help them. Both of his goals are so well taken. I wanted to spotlight him for just 1 second. As you said, it's a great ball from Pedri, who comes on in the 61st, hits that assist in the 62nd, so that's quite the impact. But it's still a really high degree of difficulty finish for Rafinha, like at full speed, to be able to track and then hit first time and hit well first time as he does. But even the first goal, there's a patience to sort of waiting and to see how the defense develops because it is sort of a chaotic moment. And then he still has to finish through traffic. I think both goals are well taken. So as long as he stays informed, that's got to make Barcelona optimistic. If PSG supporters want a reason to feel slightly optimistic, it's that I would assume João Cancelo will still be starting for Barcelona at left back. And as good as he is, I see the reasons why maybe Pep Guardiola wasn't inclined to keep him around. He shoots a couple times when he definitely had passing options.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, was it the shot from like 30 yards that sort of just dribbles wide? I'm like, ah, that's the reason.
There's that one. Is that the same one where he has two players to his right who are wide open screaming for the ball, or is that a different
one? No, that's another one.
Yeah, so there's two of those, and then there's also what definitely would have been a penalty where he clears out Kylian Mbappe. Did not need to, but does, but Mbappe was offside, so it's not given. But if I am PSG, I am looking at that left side for Barcelona and thinking, Rafinha might not be doing a ton of defensive work. Maybe we overload and just see how João Cancelo responds to that. My final note on this game and maybe for this episode is just, I don't always praise Ray Hudson. Sometimes I feel like his commentary can be a little bit repetitive. I will never get tired of and always appreciate when he is on the comms that he will give us the lookout when there's a shot about to happen, when there's a clear moment where someone is about to wind up and crack one. He will give you that little advance notice so that if you're me and you're taking notes, your head will pop up at just the right moment to be able to see that shot. That is a lovely moment of commentary that makes me love Ray Hudson and appreciate him all the more. But Graham Ruffin,
commentator for the second screen age, you could say.
There you go, exactly. There we go. Yeah. Well said.
One final note. Did you see Ronaldinho at this game?
Sort of, in that they had the obstructive shot of him seated behind somebody who refused to move their head. And I think so that was Ray Hudson saying, I want to see Ronnie in my feed was lovely.
I always think that's quite funny when you have a minor celebrity in front of a more recognizable celebrity, because that was Pierre Gasly, who's an F1 driver. I don't imagine that you know who that is.
Correct.
Taylor. But it reminds me of the picture of Robbie Keane standing next to David Beckham at the LA Galaxy. It was David Beckham and fan. Robbie Keane described as a fan. So there's an F1 driver in front of Ronaldinho.
That's amazing. Since you brought it up, Did it feel like we got more shots of famous people in the crowd in that game than we usually do? I felt like in the beginning they kept cutting to different people who were there, including Luis Figo, which felt slightly controversial.
Yeah, Luis Figo was there. There's a couple others as well. But PSG games, like the Kardashians have been to PSG games.
Gross.
And what's the Kendall Jenner or Kylie Jenner? I can't remember which one.
She's one of those. Yeah,
they are a fashion brand, PSG. So I imagine that's why they. Why they Fair. Or they try to be
the Paris fashion brand two, Barcelona debt FC three. We'll see how the return leg plays out. Graham, I look forward to being with you to talk about. Wait, no, you won't be here for those games, will you?
No, I won't. No, and the worst thing is, I will be in the air when the second legs of the Man City Real Madrid and the Arsenal Bayern game happen, which I think that's the best night. I will be somewhere over the Atlantic at that point. Let's hope there's Wi-Fi.
I was going to say, I look forward to finding out how you managed to double screen during your flight while your wife presumably takes care of your child.
Yeah, this could be like 300 screens if I could persuade everyone on the plane to put Champions League onto their screen. This could be the ultimate setup.
I have faith in you to be able to do that, Graham Ruthven. Well, I appreciate you breaking down these first legs with me. You will obviously be missed for the return legs, but the vacation is well-earned. And obviously, since you're coming to the United States, I appreciate that as well. Way to get out of the United Kingdom, Graham. Good choice.
Thanks, Taylor. When I land in the US next week, I will just shout into the air, "Hello, Taylor Rockwell!" I expect you to shout back.
Yes, and then go eat Popeye's biscuits because they're the best things in the world, and I'll hear nothing else. Graham Ruthven, thank you again. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us. We greatly appreciate it, and we will talk to you tomorrow for an episode of The Big Thing about Turkey and everything going on there. Talk to you then.